It's every election ever and beer. It's time for Ike, folks.
Bring him on.
But before we start, what's everyone drinking?
I have a Natty Greens Freedom American IPA. Matt gave me this one, so I'm looking forward to it.
That's from a brewery in Greensboro, North Carolina that's not canceled yet, but it's named after Nathaniel Green, so it could be very soon.
Also, I'm wearing my I Like Ike t-shirt, so I'm ready to go.
He is ready for tonight. So Truman spent a lot of time in South Florida during the end of his presidency. So because of that, I'm having a beer by Cigar City Brewing called Florida Cracker.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one.
It's a Belgian-style white ale brewed with white coriander and orange peel.
Did you say white cracker?
Florida cracker.
Florida cracker. Wow. And I'm drinking Miller Lite.
We need a drum roll. Do that again. And Scott's drinking a...
Miller Lite.
That is, this is Scott's big send-off for Harry Truman. So he's drinking a Missouri beer.
Way to take one for the team, Scott, and drink a Miller Lite.
Man, I'm here for that guy.
1952, man. Let's do it.
We ready?
1952, the year my parents were born.
My mother was born in 52 as well.
Well, that's it. That's everybody's parents.
And I'm still recording out of her basement, so we're good.
All right, this is the election, guys, where television changes everything. I mean, television existed in 1948, but the candidates did not really make that much use of it in 1948. But that is about to change big time in a couple of ways. If people listen to the show regularly, then they already know that campaign jingles go way back to the 1800s.
And they were always terrible.
They always, usually you just, you take a popular song, you know, one that's in the public domain that everybody has heard a million times. You take that tune and you just put words about your candidate to that tune.
Yep.
Most notably, y'all remember the 1840 election where the William Henry Harrison songs about the hard cider and log cabins and Little Van.
Yeah.
They went viral through word of mouth. And that continued on and on. And I mean, those are basically jingles.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And a good advertising jingle, as you know, sticks in your head forever. I mean, if anyone decided they wanted to donate their car to Cars for Kids, they would not have to go online and look up the number. They would know it's 1-877-CARS-FOR-KIDS. K-A-R-S, Cars for Kids.
Yeah.
That's going to be stuck in my head now.
It's terrible. It's the worst.
Yeah.
But it's effective because you literally hear it and never forget it.
Correct.
All right, so both Eisenhower and Stevenson end up using TV ads with jingles in them. And this is kind of antiquated. You couldn't make yourself, people are much more cynical now and much more savvy. You could even imagine Joe Biden having a commercial with a jingle in it, or Donald Trump having a commercial with a jingle in it, you know, like B-I-D-E-N, he's our guy. You would not ever hear anything like that now.
We need that, though.
I mean, eventually somebody will geniusly bring it back, won't they?
They would have to.
They have to.
I mean, Trump would use a song if any recording artist would allow him to.
The jingles were around for so long, up until, you know, the 1950s, and then all of a sudden they disappear. Somebody should bring them back. But the Eisenhower ad is one of the most famous ads ever. It's the one that goes, Ike for president, Ike for president. We're going to play a clip of it right now so you can hear part of the Eisenhower jingle. Have you heard it before, Scott?
Never heard this one.
Ike for president, Ike for president, Ike for president, Ike for president. You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike
for president.
Hang out the banner.
Tanner, beat the drum. We'll take Ike to Washington.
We don't want John
or Dean or Harry. Let's do that.
Those were all like
right.
Asses, by the
let's
way.
Let's get in step with the guy that's had
yeah. I know that Dean is Dean Acheson.
Like yeah.
And Harry is Harry Truman, but I don't know who John is. I don't know who that refers to.
Yeah, one of the asses had glasses. I'm assuming that's Truman.
One thing a bad song does not need is a key change.
So what'd you think, Scott?
I don't think the evolution of political songs has evolved that much from the 1700s.
It's true. It hasn't at all. And just to reinforce that point, you know, in the spirit of fair time, let's play the Stevenson ad with the jingle.
The old McDonald one?
Yeah, you can play the old McDonald one. There's an old Christmas tree one, too.
Okay.
I guess the woman singing in it is famous. I don't even know.
Yeah, that was absolutely horrid. I'll tweet that out, but it's really bad.
Yeah, nobody wants to hear that. Play the old McDonald one.
Old MacDonald had a farm back in 31. Conditions filled him with alarm back in 31. Not a chick-chick here or a moo cow there, just broken down farmland everywhere. And Farmer Mac doesn't want to go back to the days when there wasn't a moo or quack, to the days of 1931 when he didn't have bread when the day was done. Farmer Mac knows what to do, election day of 52. Gonna go out with everyone in the U.S. to vote for Adlai Stevenson to keep his farm this way. With a vote here and a vote there and a vote for Stevenson everywhere. For if it's good for Mac, you see, it's good for you and it's good for me. All America loves that farm. Vote Stevenson today.
Is it just me or do they not think much of the intelligence of their voters?
No, they didn't. I was about to say the same thing. It's like, well, we want to keep the song as close to the original as possible, but we've not said anything. We've not said everything we want to say, so we're just going to add a bunch of measures to it and make it extra horrible.
Oh, man. My favorite is how they say, notice the farm was just bad in exactly 1931. In 1932,
yeah.
All that shit got better.
Yeah, right.
Let me change that. In 1932, all that stuff got better just for Kelly's kids. I'm gonna fix that.
Just for Kelly's kids.
Yeah. The only kids we know of that listen to our show. I'm going to fix that.
Thank you for the pictures. They were amazing.
Yeah, by the way, that was awesome, Kelly. Thanks for that.
Yeah. Having fans is... I don't even have those in my own house.
Me either. My wife never listens to this podcast.
Mine either.
They hear us talk enough as it is.
All right, I have an amazing, amazing story about this election. But why don't we first hear about who the candidates are going to be in another segment of Conventional Wisdom, starring Matt Webb.
You heard that right, and it's 1952. Welcome back to Conventional Wisdom. Adlai Stevenson, that's how you pronounce it? We got some tough names in 1952. I heard them pronounce that in the song, Adlai Stevenson. I guess that's right.
We've mentioned him on the show before. Yeah. Bonus points if you can tell me when we mentioned him.
Well, I don't know. I don't remember when we mentioned him. I know when we've mentioned his grandfather. For sure. His grandfather was Grover Cleveland's vice president, the first Adlai.
That was when we mentioned it, when we talked about the original Adlai Stevenson going on the Whistle Stop tour.
Oh, yeah.
And we mentioned that later his grandson, is it his grandson?
It's his grandson. I thought it was his son, but it's his grandson. Yep.
Later his grandson would be running for president of the United States.
Is it just like a family tradition for them to run and suck?
That's a family tradition for a few families in this country.
That is true. So, par for the course, the Democratic Convention was pretty much a crap show. We've come to see that. When the Democrats cannot nominate someone on the first ballot, in fact, I tweeted this out, when any party can't nominate someone on the first ballot, their chances of winning plummet. And again, we have a non-first ballot nominee from the convention. Not only that, this guy wasn't even on any primary. He hadn't even declared his candidacy. He didn't want to run for president. In fact, he had to get pestered and pestered by Truman to run for president. There were other folks out there who wanted to run for president, and the main one has a Tennessee tie. And I knew nothing about this guy. His name is Estes Kefauver, a Tennessee senator.
Wait, that sounds like a joke, right?
No. Kefauver is his name. Truman called him Cow Fever regularly behind his back.
Well, his nickname was Cow Fever. How bad did he piss off Truman?
Well, Truman called everybody names. I'm starting to learn that. Like Truman, we said this last episode, Truman was like a Democratic Trump a little bit. He was kind of the everyman, common guy, didn't have a huge vocabulary when it came to talking to other people, and he called people names. So Cow Fever, as I'm going to call him the rest of the time because I'm probably butchering his other name anyway. So Cow Fever from Tennessee, senator, best known for his corruption hearings in the Senate. And he, because of that, because of the corruption hearings, the Democratic establishment hated this guy. Very, very much a Bernie Sanders of his day. He was a grassroots campaign that, by all accounts, probably should have been the nominee in 1952. He won almost every primary. In fact, Truman didn't really say he wasn't going to run for president in 52. He actually floated his name into the New Hampshire primary and got destroyed by this guy in the primary. He wore a coonskin cap, just like Davy Crockett, our hero in Tennessee. But Truman really controlled this nomination. Truman decided he did not want this guy to run. He kept coming after Stevenson. Stevenson kept refusing to run for president. He had just become governor of Illinois. Highly educated guy, had actually been involved in peace negotiations in World War II, was seen as a more conservative Democratic choice. Cow Fever won the first two ballots. He got 300 votes the first time, 362 votes the next time. Truman made calls to every other candidate and told them, drop out and endorse Stevenson. He's my guy. Stevenson didn't even call Truman to say, can I run, until right, I think it was the eve of the convention. And he called Truman and basically said, hey, do you mind if I submit my name or allow my name to be submitted to run for president? And Truman is pissed at that point. And he's like, what are you talking about? I've literally been bugging you for months and months to take this nomination. I brought you to the White House. I brought you to Florida. You have refused me every single time. Why in the hell do you think I'm going to be offended now that you're finally deciding to run for president? And if I want you to be the nominee, you're going to be the nominee. Probably enough about that, unless Eddie wants to add anything. But again, another brokered convention. I think the last, by the way, brokered convention that we've had was in 1952. I think after that, for the most part, we know who the nominee is going to be when they come into the conventions.
Is that right? I thought this went on a little bit longer.
Maybe that's wrong. I'll look it up and I'll delete that if it's incorrect.
I could be wrong too. But it is around this time that the interestingness of the convention dies away. It's kind of sad.
Straight to the primaries, and the delegates are pretty much locked in at that point.
Are you ready for the mind blower?
Do you want me to do the Republican convention really quick?
Oh, yeah.
It's easy.
Yeah, do it.
The nominee is Dwight Eisenhower. He finally admits that he's a Republican. By the way, one of the interesting things about Eisenhower is, turns out, at least according to legend, he had never voted until he voted for himself for president.
I love it.
Never told anyone he was involved in politics. But finally, when he tells Truman, hey, I'm a Republican, which there are rumors, and I don't know if this is true, that Truman actually offered Eisenhower the presidency and himself the vice presidency when Truman was actually running against Dewey.
That's so weird. Why would you do that? That's crazy.
Eisenhower finally acquiesced to the heads of the party asking him to run for president. The old standby, Senator Taft from Ohio, William Howard Taft's son, was headed for the nomination again and once again gets sideswiped, this time by Eisenhower, who finally said, yes, I want to run for president. After that, it was clear sailing for him. And really, the only surprise wrinkle of that convention was that a really, really young guy, I think he was 39, is that right?
39.
Senator Richard M. Nixon from California got the nomination for vice president, and part of the reason he did is he helped sway a bunch of undecided delegates to Eisenhower away from Taft. He was meddling in elections from the very beginning, and because of that, he was chosen as the nominee for vice president. Also, because of his involvement in outing Alger Hiss as a Soviet spy, he was noted for that at this point in time.
That's right. He was on HUAC, which is the House Un-American Affairs Committee, and most people, almost everybody, is familiar with Joe McCarthy from the HUAC hearings, but a lot of people do not know that Richard Nixon was actually one of the Republicans on the Un-American Affairs Committee.
Right.
What cracks me up is there's some idiots out there like me that are listening to our show. When you mention Richard Nixon's name with William Howard Taft in the same sentence, people went, what? What? That's got to be like 200 years apart.
Right.
No, they're not. And it's just funny that they're, as you get closer to the modern era, the two worlds of ancient presidential politics and kind of that quasi-modern collide. It's Richard Nixon that does it.
That's true. Essentially a generation and a half away from William Howard Taft is Richard Nixon. And
wow.
By the way, a failed campaign slogan of the time, I like Ike and Dick, did not make it off the cutting room floor. They just stuck with I like Ike.
What was that one, that Al Smith one?
Make your wet dreams come
make
true.
Make your wet dreams come true.
Gee.
And I got to give a shout out. I read an amazing book about the 1952 election by a guy named Kevin Mattson. It's called Just Plain Dick.
Am I allowed to laugh at that?
You're supposed to. That's what all the silence is about. I'm waiting for the laughter. It's called Just Plain Dick, and it's one of the best books that I've read about an election so far, maybe the best. I really enjoyed the book about the 1840 election as well, but Just Plain Dick was pretty fantastic. Now, the story that it tells...
So that one's going to get pulled and copied.
You know, we're really not mature enough to
cover Richard
Nixon.
Like this. No, we can't cover Nixon. We're just going to have to skip over this campaign.
But now, the story that is in the book is actually... It's a story that I already knew because I read about it in a book about Eisenhower, but I learned a lot more of it from this book, so... It's an amazing story. I'm going to give you my narrative of the story right now. All right, so the campaign against Adlai Stevenson, against the Democrats, against Harry Truman and Dean Acheson and the current administration and everything about the Democratic Party is called C2K1, Corruption, Communism, Korea. That's what they're running against. They're running against the supposed corruption of the Truman administration, the supposed communists that have infiltrated the government. We know there are some. We've got Joe McCarthy telling us there's 200 in the State Department. That turns out to be a big overshot. And then you have the Korean War, which people are very much losing patience with because it's a quagmire. We're in this stalemate. They're saying that Truman is not giving the guys what they need to win the war. So that's what they run on, C2K1. Now, you'll remember a few episodes back, the election of 1912, the Republican Party split wide open in that election. You had the conservative Taft wing of the party, and then on the other side, you had the sort of big government Theodore Roosevelt wing of the party. That division still very much exists. Okay, the big wig of the conservative side, like Matt talked about, is Robert Taft, the son of William Howard Taft. The big wig on the Bull Moose side is still Thomas Dewey, right? Thomas Dewey's a little bit more of a big government Republican. And a story breaks in the New York Post that Richard Nixon had accepted a fund of $18,000 from secret donors run by a guy named Dana Smith. He's a businessman in California. So this breaks in the New York Post, and the New York Post kind of implies that Nixon used the money to buy a house, which is not true. He didn't use the money to buy a house, but the New York Post hates Nixon. And so they come out with this story, and Ike is sitting here trying to run against corruption, and now there's this big scandal breaking that Nixon has this secret fund, like this slush fund that he can take money from, right? So Ike tells reporters something like his campaign has to be as clean as a hound's tooth because he doesn't want to look like the Truman administration and their corruption. So this gets Nixon into a lot of trouble with Ike, with everybody. And, I mean, he's, like, considering quitting the race. And a lot of people want him to quit the race. A lot of the insiders want him to quit. So originally when he's asked about the story, Nixon says it's obviously communists trying to smear him because he had been using his Senate seat and before that his House seat to fight against communists. Nixon refused to resign from the ticket. He talks to Thomas Dewey about the whole situation. Thomas Dewey says, well, what you ought to do is a 30-minute TV spot, and you go on and you tell your side of the story. And Nixon likes that idea, so he decides he's going to do that. He meets with Ike. Ike is so indecisive about this whole thing. He can't decide whether or not he wants to drop Nixon from the ticket. So Nixon is like in limbo. Nixon actually tells him in their meeting, like, dude, you have to shit or get off the pot. And he uses those exact words. That's a quote.
Bleep that out.
Bleep that out of there, man. So Nixon prepares and prepares to do this TV special. And the way that it's going to work is Ike says he does the special and then they wait a couple days. They see what the response is. And then he'll decide whether or not he wants Nixon to resign from the ticket. So Ike says, we'll wait a couple days, we'll see how people respond, and then we'll decide whether or not you're going to stay on the ticket with me. Now, Ike cannot kick him off the ticket, because that is going to peeve the other half of the party, right? Nixon kind of keeps the conservative part of the party happy. They don't really like Ike very much, because Ike is not very conservative, okay? It makes sense that people didn't know whether he was a Democrat or a Republican because Ike doesn't know if he's a Democrat or a Republican. He's like the Mitt Romney of his time.
What a horrible insult for Ike.
Yeah, I know. I didn't mean it like that, but I meant
he's almost a John McCain, right?
McCain probably is a better comparison to Eisenhower. I think that McCain would have loved Eisenhower. I don't know. But I'm going to guess that McCain would have loved Ike. All right, so Nixon has this thing all set up. He's going to go on TV. He's going to talk about what happened. He gets to the studio, and he's preparing. And a phone call comes in for him. And it's Thomas Dewey. And Thomas Dewey says, look, Ike's guys had a meeting. And at the end of the show, you are to resign from the ticket. So after you tell your side of the story, last few minutes of your TV spot, you resign from the ticket, announce that you're resigning. And Nixon is pissed. It's been days, and he's been kept in limbo, and then they call him right before the speech and tell him that he's off the ticket. So Nixon went on TV, and he delivered his speech. And we're going to play some clips from it. It's a really famous speech. Let me tell you, this TV spot would not fly today. It would go over about as well as the old McDonald ad did. It is cheesy. It appeals to an idealism that I don't think exists in very many voters today. And also, it's rather insulting to the intelligence. The arguments that he makes are, you know, the whole thing is a little bit maudlin. It's like, it's a bunch of political things that today, like, you would spot right away. It's super pandery. But we're going to play some clips from it. So, you just got done watching the Milton Berle show, and now suddenly a special message from Senator Richard Nixon comes on.
My fellow Americans, I come before you tonight as a candidate for the vice presidency and as a man whose honesty and integrity has been questioned. Now, the usual political thing to do when charges are made against you is to either ignore them or to deny them without giving details. I believe we've had enough of that in the United States, particularly with the present administration in Washington, D.C. To me, the office of the Vice Presidency of the United States is a great office, and I feel that the people have got to have confidence in the integrity of the men who run for that office and who might obtain it. I have a theory, too, that the best and only answer to a smear or to an honest misunderstanding of the facts is to tell the truth.
You know, it's so weird to think about Richard Nixon, like, pre-Watergate.
I was thinking the same thing.
You just can't separate him from it when you're born, you know, into a world where he's already done everything, you know?
Yep. Yeah.
But then he goes on to explain himself in clip two, and his argument is like, you know, I set up this fund because I didn't want taxpayers to have to pay for me to make copies of my speeches.
It isn't very much, but Pat and I have the satisfaction that every dime that we've got is honestly ours. I should say this, that Pat doesn't have a mink coat, but she does have a respectable Republican cloth coat. And I always tell her that she'd look good in anything. One other thing I probably should tell you, because if I don't, they'll probably be saying this about me, too. We did get something, a gift, after the election. A man down in Texas heard Pat on the radio mention the fact that our two youngsters would like to have a dog. And believe it or not, the day before we left on this campaign trip, we got a message from the Union Station in Baltimore saying they had a package for us. We went down to get it. You know what it was? It was a little Cocker Spaniel dog in a crate that he'd sent all the way from Texas. Black and white, spotted. And our little girl, Tricia, the six-year-old, named it Checkers. And you know, the kids, like all kids, love the dog. And I just want to say this right now, that regardless of what they say about it, we're going to keep it.
Now, I know you'll remember a couple episodes back. It was actually 8 years before this. FDR, during the election of 1944, his best line in the whole campaign was when he talked about his dog, Fala. You remember? They've attacked me. They've attacked my family. But now they've gone too far. They've attacked my little dog, Fala.
Yeah.
Well, Richard Nixon loved that line. He thought that it was genius. And so he wanted to take that line and put his own little spin on it, and that's what he did. So he said, well, we did accept one gift, you know, our little dog Checkers, and we're not giving him back. Oh, man. Nixon says he didn't want the taxpayers to have to pay for Senate office work. He said the other thing that he could have done was put his wife on the payroll like other guys do, but that he wasn't going to do that because it was dishonest. And he said, you know, Democrats think that the only way that you should be allowed to run for office is if you're rich and you can afford all that stuff on your own. But I think that the founding fathers intended for anybody to be able to run for office, even if they're not rich. And that explains why I have to have this slush fund. Adlai Stevenson, it turned out, it broke right like the day before. He had a similar fund that was for the exact same thing. It was the exact same fund, which was funny because the DNC, the head of the DNC had said that Richard Nixon must, oh my God, he has this fund, he must withdraw from the race. There's no other honorable thing to do. And then all of a sudden it comes out that Stevenson has the exact same thing. All right, so here's the good part. You ready? Nixon goes on and he talks about how he had to have the money in order to fight communism and corruption. He talks about his World War II service. He says, I was just there when the bombs were falling. I wasn't any big general or anything like that. I was just a regular guy. He insinuates that the newspaper opinion writers are really just mad at him for fighting communism, specifically for what happened to Alger Hiss, who was a real communist who actually went to prison, who was actually indicted in the whole Red Scare. He ends this thing, he gets up, and he starts shaking his fist. It's all real phony. And then he said, all the candidates, including Ike, should release complete financial histories just the way that he was doing, which actually he knew was terrible for Ike, because Ike was trying to hide some fantastic tax rates that he had received. And then he says, you know, they told him before the special started that he had to quit, that he was to resign at the end. So he stands there and he says, I don't believe I ought to quit, because I am not a quitter.
And now, finally, I know that you wonder whether or not I am going to stay on the Republican ticket or resign. Let me say this. I don't believe that I ought to quit, because I'm not a quitter. And incidentally, Pat's not a quitter. After all, her name was Patricia Ryan, and she was born on St. Patrick's Day, and you know the Irish never quit. But the decision, my friends, is not mine. I would do nothing that would harm the possibilities of Dwight Eisenhower to become president of the United States. And for that reason, I am submitting to the Republican National Committee tonight through this television broadcast the decision which it is theirs to make. Let them decide whether my position on the ticket will help or hurt. And I'm going to ask you to help them decide. Wire and write the Republican National Committee whether you think I should stay on or whether I should get off. And whatever their decision is, I will abide by it.
Oh, that's great. I'm going to kick this can down the street.
Okay. What kind of objects were being thrown at the television by the Republican National Committee when they heard him say that? I mean, they had to have been absolutely livid. Eisenhower's people.
What this displays to me is you have a candidate that knows he has position over the committee itself because of his popularity of a certain segment of the party that makes it impossible for the party to be elected if he's not on the ticket. He knows that. It's a beautiful power move.
Yeah,
if you ask
it
me.
Really is. I totally agree with you. I think you got it 100%. And I too believe that it's a killer power move.
Well, yeah, I mean, what can you do? What can you do about it after he does that?
There's nothing you can do.
Right. It's a power move, but it's a
he has the party. He has the committee by the short and curlies. There's nothing that they can do.
Absolute power move, but complete, and I really don't mean this as a pun, it's a complete dick move to do that. I mean, it really is. I mean, think about it.
He invented the dick move.
I mean, that is...
No, that's exactly right. I mean, there's a lot of things that if you ask me, that if all you knew of Nixon was that clip and then the rest of his history after Watergate, you would see a lot of foreshadowing of the history that was written. And, you know, he was he's beautifully vague, very similar to what FDR was. But in the same way that FDR knew he had all the cards and he was the dealer, you know, Nixon knew the same thing on a much smaller scale because he wasn't elected president yet. But it's foreshadowing that it's a guy that is, and really the guy that plays those moves the best are egomaniacs. And maybe sociopaths are never wrong. They're never incorrect. And they're, it's just, it's really good foreshadowing, in my opinion, of what's going to happen to Nixon in the future.
Yeah.
Yeah. So good. I mean, I'm surprised this isn't a story that everyone knows, but I didn't know about this until I read Eisenhower in War and Peace, I think it's called. Man, the story blew me away. And Ike, when he's sitting there watching the speech, and he hears live on TV that last clip that we heard where Nixon says, write letters to the RNC and tell them. He was holding a pencil in his hand, and he just cracked it.
I can imagine that. I mean...
Oh, man.
Whew, yeah.
But all these telegrams started rolling in, thousands and thousands of them.
How could they not? They're saving checkers. You tell a sob story about a dog and your wife, of course they're going to write in.
I wish that this was a video podcast so that you could see it, because when he starts talking, he's sitting at a desk and he's giving this speech. And then when he starts talking about his wife, Pat, the camera zooms out and she's sitting there on a couch next to him, just staring at him. And she never talks. She just sits there staring at him. It's so weird and awkward. Pat doesn't have a mink coat, but she does have a respectable Republican cloth coat. And the mink coat thing, I think that was an allusion to some secretary in the Truman administration who somebody gave her a mink coat on the government. It was one of the corruption stories. And so that's, I think, what he was alluding to there. So, I mean, yeah, thousands and thousands of telegrams roll in. It's like the movie Miracle on 34th Street where they come in with all the letters from Santa Claus. Y'all know what I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah. That's fantastic.
Yeah. I mean, it's a dated reference, but it's such a great – it's iconic, really, so it can't be a dated reference, I think. People start sending him dog collars and dog treats and dog toys for checkers. I mean, it all just comes rolling in, and Ike ends up stuck with him.
For 8 years.
For 8 years, and Ike has heart attacks while he's president and cannot perform the duties of president for long stretches of time, and he gets real worried that Nixon is in there. He takes a lot of pains to make sure that Nixon won't be pulling the strings of government or making the decisions while Ike is, you know, confined to his bed because he's had a heart attack. Well, that's my big election story.
It's benign, really, right? This election. I mean, it's a slaughter.
I think the story of this election is really that. Also, Ike has to work with Joe McCarthy a little bit to get elected because he needs the McCarthy supporters to support him, but really he finds it grossly distasteful. He hates Joe McCarthy. He really wants nothing to do with him, but he sort of plays the game. He gets the endorsement that he needs. You know how it is.
Yeah. I've got some stories too. And this will be a good transition to the map, because there's just briefly, if you watch some of this coverage on YouTube, I urge you to go out and start finding the election coverage from here on out, really, because it's out there. There's like live coverage of all these elections, and the things that we're talking about here are out there, and you can find them, and they're just really interesting to watch. And for example, this coverage of the election and election night was anchored by Walter Cronkite and had Edward R. Murrow on it, which is kind of incredible. You're starting to hear names like Scott talked about of, you know, people that we know about that were actually broadcasting news while we were watching news, even if we were young, were actually covering these elections back then. It's kind of incredible stuff. One of the best stories was this UNIVAC computer. Have you heard about that?
No.
I have not.
So there's this company, and the company is called the Remington Rand Company. And they approached CBS, and they said, we have this 8-ton walk-in computer the size of a one-car garage that you access with hinged metal doors. It costs about $1 million, but we have this idea. We're going to feed all this data into it based on all these previous elections and how the Electoral College went. We're going to feed that into our UNIVAC, or our Universal Automatic Computer. And as the night goes on, we're going to allow that computer to predict the results. And so CBS had someone that was actually sitting beside the UNIVAC, and they were plugging in numbers as they came in from the states and what they were going to predict the election to happen. So it's really like what we would watch now. And so,
yeah.
How did it do?
Well, that's what I'm going to get to. Before the election, really the polls and everything else were predicting, and the pundits were predicting anything from a Democratic landslide to a narrow Republican victory. It was all over that kind of spectrum, because remember, how long, Eddie, since we've had a Republican president? It's been since 32 or 30.
28 is the last time that a Republican won an election, and that was Herbert Hoover in 28.
Absolutely. So here's the crazy story about this. The first prediction that UNIVAC threw out was so laughable to its programmers and to its pundits. The first prediction they threw out, that they scrapped the programming of it and added human element data back to it to make it start to read what they thought was more correct information. The first prediction was Eisenhower 438, Stevenson 93.
Almost nailed it.
Almost perfectly. Wow. And they go on to say, well, this is a real, you hear Cronkite and Murrow say, this is a real embarrassment for, you know, UNIVAC and for this company, blah, blah, blah. They had predicted this to be a close election. And then they go to the UNIVAC guy, and he's like, we just want to say UNIVAC's a great computer. It actually predicted this exactly, and we screwed it up. We went back and changed all the numbers. And if you look at the map, man, it's crazy. It's 442 to 89. Eisenhower blew him out.
That's so typical. That's exactly what the Democrats would do now. They'd be like, well, clearly the computer is broken.
Yeah.
Of course, now the computer would be programmed to declare the Democrat the winner.
It says, here it says, UNIVAC was less than 1% off on its initial prediction.
Man, that's amazing. That's a good, that's well done, Matt. Good story.
Yeah. So let's go to the map. Does somebody have the map pulled up?
Dude, it's red.
It's really red.
Except the South. They're still voting for Democrats.
Yep. Georgia actually voted Democrat this time around, and Tennessee voted Eisenhower.
So I guess all the Dixiecrats didn't decide to become Republicans yet.
What's really happening is you can see it start to become not really divided on racial grounds, but more on urban versus rural is really what's happening.
Yeah.
It's exactly what I said last week.
Yeah. It's very interesting. But we're going to look at that as we go through every single election from now on.
I think that's it, unless you have anything else. Oh, yeah, and we did, by the way, we got a new review on Apple Podcasts. So go out and review us on any podcast app that you use. We got a 5-star review that says best podcast ever, which I do not think is hyperbole at all. I think that's entirely accurate.
Yeah, let me fact check that real quick. Yep. Checks out.
Checks out.
Checks out. Just ask my mom.
Yeah, true story.
She agrees.
All right, one more thing. I just wanted to say real quick that Harry Truman actually could have run again, even though the 22nd Amendment had passed, which says if you serve more than 2 years of someone else's term, which Harry Truman did, and then your own term that you were elected to, then you're done. You can't be president anymore. But Harry Truman is the one person that was grandfathered in and could have run for president again, but he chose not to.
Now, that's some good bar trivia.
That's what we're here for.
That's right. Special thanks to all of our listeners out there in podcast land, especially those on Parler. We've had a lot of great traction lately with Parler, and we certainly appreciate that. Matt, go ahead and tell everybody where they can get a hold of us on social media.
So on Parler, just like on Twitter and Facebook, we're at Election and Beer. So go out to every one of those social media apps and follow us. check out our content on those apps, you'll find lots of things like the YouTube videos we talk about and those awesome election songs that you'll all want to sing with all of your family. I'm sure they'll appreciate that. Then also make sure you subscribe to us on any podcast app that you happen to listen to, and come back next week for the exciting blowout election of 1956.
Sounds good.